talk about the stuff you like. And let you talk on the mic. Everything we talk about is the stuff you like. It's the Capital City Podcast.
Hit me.
Yeah, license free. It's the Capital City Podcast. I'm your host, Capital J, alongside my main man,
D.L. Glass.
And tonight, we're going to talk to somebody that's got many years in the game behind the scenes on the promo side. You say, well, what's the promo side? Well, as a DJ that spent a lot of time on radio, we talk to these guys pretty regularly. And promotions, they promote the records that the label is trying to get popping. So those guys' job is kind of like a salesman. They're selling the records to me and other DJs. Mm-hmm. But I have one of the best in the business.
Okay.
I always play his records.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was so good. Fat Tommy, ladies and gentlemen.
What's up, Capital J? What's up, D.L. Glass? How you brother doing? Hello, universe. How y'all out there in our radio land or podcast land? What land we in? Podcast land?
Yeah, we're in podcast land right now.
But they could be streaming it, or they could hear it on their computer or their phone or
Alexa.
Radio. Can they hear it on the radio as well, though?
Fire Stick.
In your car, you can, right. If you got, right, Fire Stick. And then you got the apps on your radio in your car that you can listen.
That's right.
They got apps on the radio in their car.
Yep, you can catch us on OBA Radio on Sundays, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. You're on OBA, okay.
Yeah, rocking out with Polo and K-Nice.
That's right. That's what it is. They doing my music. I'm going to do some drops for the show.
Word. I was listening to OBA on the way here.
I listen a lot to. It's good because you know I teach the history of hip hop, so it's good for me. It keeps me right there when they go back. I tell my class, you know, they can get a good blend of old school and then some new stuff on the weekends. But pretty much, you can hear a lot of good records
right.
from the '90s,
right?
Well, from every generation, not just the '90s. What radio used to sound like, you know, you would hear. The ones that have been in rotation for 100 years that's in reoccurring, and then you always got the new stuff.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I rocks with Obia.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Well, Tommy, since we got you here, now when we have a guest on, you know, the show ain't about us, it's about you, and we're gonna get into a topic, but first. I want people to understand what qualifies you to be a guest on the podcast.
Because we don't just have anybody else.
Okay.
So we clear.
Okay.
Now, if you've been listening, Fat Tom is a guy that was, he was with us for the Andre Willis interview.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with us for my man,
Blue.
Diamond.
Blue Diamond.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Who gave us a whole
Blue
rundown.
Digital, yeah.
Yep, who gave us a whole rundown. About licensing your music.
Mm-hmm.
So he's already plugged up. But this man has extensive experience in the music business. So first of all, let's talk about you for a second. How did you get interested in hip hop? And how did you find yourself working for these major labels?
Interested in hip hop, you know, I grew up hip hop. I can remember the first time BLS played Sugar Hill Gang.
Ooh.
You know, 19 to, you know, before that, but wait, before that, I had the Gap Band 5, they had a record, King Tim the Third.
Oh, that was Fatback.
Yes. Fatback. Fatback Band, yes. They had King Tim the Third. Yes, they had that, and that was out in March before
Rappers
the Sugar Hill Gang. Yeah, that came out at the end of the summer.
Yep.
That was the last record I bought before. See, my parents moved from, my mother left my father in that year. So at the end of the summer, my mother left and came back to Martinsville, left Connecticut and came to Martinsville. And I was up there with my dad all summer. And then that record dropped and my mother said, I got to come to Virginia.
Oh, right when it was about to explode.
Right, so I left and had that record and all my stuff packed up. You know, you moving, you going to your mother, you know, so you got all your stuff packed up. And that was one of the things, like that record, because when I got down south with that record, nobody had it. It was just hitting. Like, imagine when now I leave, we go to Martinsville that Saturday. About the time I get to Martinsville, QMG is playing it in Greensboro, you know, because that's what you listen to
right
in Martinsville, you know.
Right. So that's 97.
Now they're about to play the record, right? So then I realized that, look, I had a record before radio, you know. And so then I went, whoa. So that was like my first real introduction to like understand the music. And then that became my whole life. My whole life became going to Connecticut and getting mixes off the radio and bringing them down south and having records before anybody else had them. As a teenager, that was like a thing for me, you know.
I want to throw this in there. I had a lot of family in Connecticut too, and that's how I got my exposure as well. They were bringing back tapes off the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they would go up for the summer, spend the whole summer up there, and then right before the school year starts, it was open season on them tapes.
Everybody from down south will come to Connecticut in the summertime, and everybody from Connecticut will go
down south.
That's crazy, right?
One way or the other, you know, that's the way it was. You all, everybody in Connecticut was from down south. That was a fact. I don't care. Everybody, y'all really from down south, but okay.
That's right. About New York too.
Yep.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah.
And you said New York, Martinsville.
Martinsville.
Yep. For those of you that don't know, I got to give a quick shout out to Martinsville, Danville area, and my man Grandmaster Slice. Yeah.
Well, you know, they got to know where Martinsville is because, you know, they got the Martinsville Speedway.
Right. Yeah, oh, wow. Boy. So you were importing all this hip hop, bringing down south, and.
Yeah. Just as a teenager, that's what I did. So imagine this. As a teenager, I would go to Connecticut, you know, and have my cousins make me tapes and mail them to me and everything. So I'm constantly getting tapes and then putting them out basically in the streets down south, you know, playing them, taking them to the skating rink, getting the DJ to play this record because I got, you know, I got the mix of Planet Rock and Kraftwerk. And the Tom Tom Club, that Hot Night, that the master mix from Kiss. So I got that mix on there, and I'm taking these mixes to the skating rink, and the DJ is throwing them in there like he mixing, and he putting it on there and fading out the Kiss master mix, you know. So
right.
That became my job. Really, New York would send me records. You know, the Wu-Tang Clan. So first record was Players Ball. So that didn't come from New York. That came from Atlanta. But Atlanta sent me records. And my job is to give it to all the DJs, go to the club, and get all the clubs to play it.
So that's the
hustle right there.
So how did you get turned on to the promo game? And explain to people, you know, like you just gave them a taste. They send you the records, and you're out here distributing them in the flesh. But how did you get the contact to even know that this is something that could be done?
So, okay. I was living in Richmond, and I wanted to have my own TV show. I thought I was going to be the next Arsenio Hall. I wanted to film my own TV show, host it, and do it. So I had been carrying a camera in the military, and I then worked at a media audiovisual media specialist at ironically at the university I teach at now at VCU, and so I was going back to the Art Institute of Dallas to be a film person, and I had just had a baby, so I was going to be out there with my baby mama, see my daughter being raised in school, same time. That ain't make it 6 weeks. So
it was a good idea though. Sound good on paper. Had Raheem already dropped? when you got
when
there?
When I was in Dallas, some people liked the way Sally walks.
Okay, so this is before, right? Well, no, this is probably, yeah, this is after, right?
It's like 1988 or 1989. I can't remember, but I remember that some people liked the way Sally walked. Was out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is, Raheem is about to drop then.
So it had to be, it's after N.W.A. because I remember when N.W.A. dropped Fuck the Police, I had already heard Eazy-E had Boys in the Hood, It's Always Hard. You come mess with us and we'll pull your card. That was going around Dallas as a single, like when I was in the Air Force, like 1987,
right?
88. Jeez. You know, he had, it was the early, not the early, it was the late 80s, but way before 89, 90, because Fuck the Police was 89, 90, somewhere around there. But yeah, so I left there and went to Atlanta, because one of my homeboys I grew up with was from Atlanta. They had moved back home. He was in Atlanta. They had the Art Institute of Atlanta. They had a good audiovisual program. I went there, and when I got to Atlanta, everything they was teaching you about camera and editing, I knew. I had already worked at a TV station. Like, I got there and was like, wow, I'm going to waste my money. They're about to tell me something that I know way more. I had worked at a TV station. Like, I had came out the military and worked at Channel 63, which when I first got out of the military, I met the guy who built the Fox network. He was going around developing UHF stations and then selling them to Fox. Wow. So he would come to a small town, buy up the UHF station, go out and get some sales dollars, you know, develop a sales team, develop a market, prove that it generates income, and then sell it to Fox.
So when you guys talked about your early days of you going and getting the music in the hands of the DJs, just to kind of put it in perspective, because a lot of artists, they'll never know that part of it. How would you approach a DJ to get them to play the music?
Well, it started with me being in Richmond. I was already in the clubs. Mm-hmm. I was already a club head. No matter what city I was in, Atlanta. When I was in Atlanta, we were throwing parties and promoting parties. That's how we ate. So when I came back to Richmond, I knew all the club owners pretty much. I knew the club owners only because I was in the clubs. I met a guy named Ed Connick that I was doing an internship for BMG. And he said, you know, you probably would do better on the promotion side than the sales side because you're going to have to go in the store. So he started showing me exactly, you know, that's how I met Willie's Records and Lou and all of them. But that came from that side. So then he was telling me about record promoters. Then I bought a book called Hitmen and read just a book on what a record promoter was. I'm like, well, yeah, that's exactly what I do anyway. Right. So my thing was to dominate the clubs. I knew all the club DJs. So I would go to them first and say, yo, tell me if this record is good. I think it's the bomb. Now, mind you, my first record was Player's Ball.
Okay.
My second record was Protect Your Neck. My third record was Juicy. Okay. So,
damn. Yeah, so your job was easy.
Yeah.
Man, you ain't done no work.
You know what I'm saying? Now, nigga, you buy me a drink because I let you play this.
When I got a job, when I went to work at Warner Brothers, that's what A.D. Washington said to me. He was like, so at, I had worked Tribe Called Quest, Midnight Marauders. I had worked KRS-One, I'll call it in a minute, but I can't. All the records, Keith Murray, The Most Beautifulest Thing. Like,
yeah, you had, it's funny.
So long.
You know, it's funny. I was just telling D.L., I said, now, when Fat Tom was at Warner Brothers, he had to work.
That's what AD said when I got there. He said, so when I told him all the records, he said, oh, shit, you ain't did no work. You're going to have to work here. We don't have no hits. But this is what he's telling me. Like, but he's saying, we don't have no hits. You about to learn how to work a record now. Yeah. He told me I was going to learn how to work a record. And that's truly where I learned. Like, you don't know how to work a record until the company's telling you to work a record that you know is no good. Like, that doesn't matter. When I would tell AD that, he would go, "That okay, the record's no good. Thank you. Bad timing. The record's no good. Okay, now, how are we going to get it played?"
Right.
Because the company says, this is the record we got to put out. Mm-hmm. This is the record you got to run around town with. So how you make it happen? And that was the game. And that's when I learned to promote records.
Yeah, I think the best thing y'all had going, I think the best thing that probably came out of that era was probably something for the people.
We have My Love Is the Shit.
That was it. Something for the people.
My Love. DJ Kool, Let Me Clear My Throat.
Oh, that's right. That Deaf American was under Warner Brothers, wasn't it?
Me Clear My Throat. Hold It. You can't tell me you wasn't feeling Not Enough. They had the remake of Basketball with Curtis Blow on it.
It was good.
It was terrible. I used to tell them, girl, this is not enough. Y'all is really tough. Whoever told y'all is Denise and them wasted so much money, and Curtis, you are not helping them.
Yeah, they gave y'all a couple of sound. Y'all had a couple of soundtracks.
I had to fight to get the Living Single, man. I was trying to exploit the fact that we had Living Single. I was like, man, let's go get some of that money. Come on. So I used to stay on the set because, you know, and when I worked at Warner Brothers, it was on the Warner lot. You know, you could go eat lunch with Wesley Snipes. They was doing 1500 during then. They was doing Murphy Brown was on the lot. Space Jam was on the lot. The lot was jumping back then.
I remember the Space Jam. That Space Jam soundtrack had a few decent cuts on it.
Yes, but the lot, when you could go over there, our office, the record company side, you would be on the film studio lot.
Oh, wow.
So the cafeteria, you eating on the lot with all the actors. That's what I'm saying. The lot was jumping. Warner Brothers as a record company was terrible, but you go to lunch and on the Warner Brothers lot.
That sounds dope. It's funny you brought it up because I was just telling DL. Yeah. I said, yeah, Tommy, like, you know, you worked the hell out of them records, like, just to get one, like, you know what I'm saying? You got to build relationships.
Yes.
To get favors done, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Well, when I got Chino XL played, I knew I had a lot of people that liked me. You know, I got
Chino.
So you know what? That was us rolling with Chino XL in San Diego.
Yeah, was me, Chino,
you, Chino, and that dude that had the boat.
Yep, my man Mark.
Yep, that was the first time I rode in the Lincoln Navigator.
Wow.
Yeah. Had one brand new.
Y'all riding around with some garbage.
Hey, nah, Chino, I like Chino. Chino had that song Creep. He was dope.
Creep.
And he was a good dude, man. Like, he was just a chill guy to be around, man. I really enjoyed Chino.
Like, we needed a better beat selection. It was beat selection.
Yeah, but he was a great rapper though. Like, there's
no this.
Like,
is, I feel this like was really.
I feel like he
would have been a superstar if Dr. Dre would have produced him, because he was just the Dr. Dre. When he got Eminem, he only thought about Chino XL.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. He predated Eminem with that type of wordplay.
It's so crazy.
He put it in there. It was acceptable from a white boy. That style, because of the words and everything, would work. But Chino, that would be a good battle right there.
Yeah,
I never heard of Chino XL until Tupac said Chino XL for you too.
Yeah. Hey, and I thought I was like, what? And after having met Chino, I was like, what? Why you jump on Chino? Yeah. This dude cool as hell.
Well, I was watching Drink Champ, and during the Drake Champ, Talib Kweli said, getting dissed by Kanye, or Kanye saying your name, it don't matter, it's good for you.
Yes.
And when Tupac said, fuck Chino XL, my job got a lot easier.
I bet it did.
Like, when I would walk in with the record and say Chino could rap, people wouldn't say who is Chino, because he did enough rapping to upset Tupac. But that's because he said, Chino said, F you and your dope fiend mama. The harmony from Dear Mama, and said F you and your dope fiend mama, and that's why Tupac said it. Then he said the album when he's looking like Jesus walking on water, he said Tupac cried, Tupac died and I cried.
Hey Tommy, here's one thing. Yep. like you being a promo guy, I was on a panel one time back in the day, and I remember J. Cole was in there. And I know you remember back in the day, J. Cole did a little bit of promo work, A&R style stuff. He would be on the phone. I forget what label it was before he really got his footing in as an artist. And one of the questions came up, do you have to pay to get a song on the radio? J. Cole said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And
depends
really,
on what your definition of getting it on the radio means.
Well, and I think both of those things are true at the same time.
Yeah, both of them are true.
Both of them are true absolutely. At the same time. And my take on it is, if you have to pay for it, that's the indication that it's not a hit. If Fat Tommy brings me a record and says,
no, that's not true.
Well, this is okay. This is my. Well, let's take this from my DJ perspective. You can give me the promo perspective side from your side.
Go ahead.
From my side, if you bring me a record and it's dope, it's a hit. I'm not gonna argue with you. You're not gonna have to do. You're not gonna have to take me to dinner.
Right.
You're not gonna have to send me some promos. You don't have to do anything because I'm glad that you just send me the record. Like, for example, you send me Protect Your Neck or Players Ball, for example. I would have automatically recognized that as
a hit.
These are records I can rock with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you send me Not Enough, it's time to go sit down and talk.
Now, there are certain stations that existed. I don't know. It's been a long time since I approached radio. But there are certain stations that existed that if you didn't pay, your record couldn't get played, period. Because, one, you can't get on the list, so it don't matter.
Right.
I could give it to you all day long, but I ain't on the list. So if I ain't on the list, then you play it, you jeopardizing your job. But that's not every station. So, yeah, there's always another station. I would say that a hit record is a hit record is a hit record. But there's some stations that it don't matter. So if you get a promo budget.
You say they don't care. Some stations don't care if it's a hit or not. They still want you to.
I'm not rocking with you, right.
Want you to pay. Right.
Oh, hey, wow. Buddy. It's not happening. So I used to carry it as the word with me is if they gave me the promo budget to promote. And so me, I was into the trickle down effect.
Right.
If I had it, I gave it to everybody. Like, and it wasn't to play a record. I never paid to play a record. It was because they gave it to me to give it away. Like when you was at the airport in Miami and couldn't, whatever the situation was, it wasn't my money. It's the company's money. So why wouldn't I do it?
Right. When my bag got lost that time.
Yeah, all of that. So
yeah,
why
Fat Tommy looked out for me.
It's not my money. So the situation, really, people get there and start acting like it's their money. I never treated it like it was my money.
Well, you know, on the flip side of that, I never took any dime. Like, as far as somebody just giving me money to play a record, I never took a dime to play a record. And the reason I operated like that was because I didn't want to owe anybody and ruin my own legacy by playing some trash.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but what if I got a budget for Players Ball and they say go spend $5,000 in North Carolina on Players Ball.
Well, then when
let me just tell you this. This is what I generally did in the Carolinas. That's not just you. That speaks for the entire region. Generally, I would just have very large dinners with all the guys and play the record.
Right? Yeah, that's it.
Because the record that I had, we're going out to eat. It's a great record. I'm going to get it to you early. You know, people would they'd be waiting for me to come to town with the next Bad Boy record. Like, so when you have Bad Boy, So I had all, I had Flavor in Your Ear, Juicy, Unbelievable, you know, every Biggie record.
I still got the t-shirt. I still got the Craig Mack Flavor in Your Ear t-shirt. It said Bad Boy Run the World 94.
Wow. Yeah. Rest in peace.
So then you got all the Outkast records, plus Goody Mob with Cell Therapy. And so I had a lot of great records. Then the Wu-Tang, and then M-E-T-H-O-D Man, and Protect Your Neck. And then I wrote to Cal. Shoot. I mean, it's a lot of records. Mm-hmm. A lot of great records. I wrote D'Angelo, Brown Sugar, Jill Scott, Who Is Jill Scott? Something for the People, My Love Is the Shit.
Yeah, we took them to the strip club one time in Greensboro. I think you were there, weren't you?
I was definitely there.
Yeah. Now, other than the DJs, what? How else did you work a record?
Yeah, tell us about the program directors.
I would befriend the overnight guys. Look, for me, my hustle would be getting the dudes that's
on the way up.
4 o'clock in the morning. You know, because I'm reading a sheet. At my job is to get spins. It's to increase the spins. So you don't use all the spins the first week. That's why I would say I need you this week. It's real strategic about how you move it, because I'm trying to move a record to show a flow so I can hand it off to the regionals who are now have to go for rotation. So I'm only trying to build an audience so when they go to have the record added to the station, it presents well. So I have to paint a picture. So the picture I'm painting is how many stations can I get on it? And back in them days, I would have 4 weeks. You have 4 weeks to get a record popping. If it ain't popping 4 weeks, 5 weeks, you know, they on to the next single. And if you don't hit most artists back then on their first single, they didn't get no second single. At Arista, you know, we was blessed, but you wasn't getting a second single if the first one didn't work. Unless your name was Deborah Cox. Other than that, nobody at Arista was getting second singles. Like, it was already written.
Right. That group, The Rain, was on Arista, weren't they?
Who?
The Rain, Didn't You Know. It was a song I thought it was dope. Rich Harrison produced it, and I never heard anything out of those girls again. And I thought, I was thinking to myself, they dropped the ball on this group.
I had Total. We forced Total through. That was like, that was just hype.
Well, you know, with that first single with Biggie on the front of it, I mean, that seemed like that seemed like something that wouldn't have been hard to promote,
right? So you had a podcast. Well,
I had a lot until I got to Warner Brothers.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. Warner Brothers was tough.
I had a 2 year drought. So, you know, but I had some good promo stuff. I had signed Shaq sneakers. I had Shaq dolls from the movie Shazam. Steel. I had those. I had, because he had Shaq Fu out back then. I had that record. Mm-hmm. He was Shaq Fu with the Fu Schnickens. Mm-hmm. He was over there on Quest Records. And I had...
So Quest had some decent stuff on it.
No, they did not. They were terrible. But Mark Prasad was attached to Quincy Jones, so Quincy Quest, the key was for Quincy. So the records, that's how we got the Living Single soundtrack and stuff. That was that. But I wasn't really feeling in something for the people. They was okay as producers, but I mean, I was really on, like, back then I really liked Dallas Austin, Jermaine Dupri, and Organized Noise. Like,
dope.
That's who I always thought was.
Like, yeah. But you know, honestly, as a DJ, when I saw Quest, I gave it a little more attention than just the Warner Brothers label. Like it wasn't always terrible. Like, I knew it. And the problem was, I thought they put out some decent music, but they didn't put out hits.
Well, to me, it was a good album. I mean, it was all right. It was Tamia. You know, she had Grant Hill. She had a tour bus. We had a good budget. You know, I really loved working Tamia's project. You know what? One of the best projects I ever worked.
Oh, yeah. Tamia made noise.
Yeah. Shoot. I spent $30,000 in 1 month.
Now, do you think
Warner
Brothers was missing on the hits because they had I guess, revenue coming in, or their focus on so many things that they didn't concentrate on.
Here's what it was. Time Warner, as a corporation, was trying to get in cable television. Okay, this is pre-cable. Mm-hmm. Time Warner, which Warner Brothers is a subsidiary of Time Warner.
Right.
Okay. They are trying to get in the cable. So in 1992, they told us that we couldn't curse on records. Warner Brothers, no, they was going to drop something for the people for the My Love is the Shit. They could not curse on records. So at the time that the whole world is beginning to curse, you are forbidden to curse. Or have, that's why Fozzie and them, they can't take their clothes off, because Warner Brothers, Time Warner as a corporation, couldn't be seen. The FCC wasn't going to mess with them if they were seen any way, shape, form, or fashion on negative light. So we was fighting with gloves on.
Right, right.
Hmm. Tied with our hands tied behind our back, but a whole lot of money. Yeah. A whole lot of money.
A whole lot of money. At the conventions, I used to love to see Fat Tommy coming at the conventions.
Yeah.
And now, for those of you who don't know, the conventions, like, they had a few of them, like Impact, which was a radio trade magazine, mm-hmm. would have a convention every year.
Okay.
And you had an Urban Network would have a convention every year.
Yeah. While you're mentioning conventions, could you talk a little bit about what the conventions entailed and what could possibly come?
Well, this is, like, from my end, I'm gonna let Tommy tell what it meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
What it meant to me was, this is a place, depending on the type of convention.
Okay.
Like, some of them more geared towards programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you had a Mix Show Power Summit geared towards the Mix Show DJs.
Okay.
That's, you know, you get them on a record, they can help sell it to the program director. But when you get there, what I saw in the convention is a place where all the labels can have access to everybody. You can play all the music that you want to promote right there in person, get a good feel for whether it's working. You can see their faces when the song comes on. You can see if heads bop.
Okay.
You can build relationships, and you take these records back home. And for all intents and purposes, it was the place where people could make those connections that, you know, I say, should you pay for a record? People who needed to be paid could get paid directly at a convention.
Okay.
But this is just from my end. Like, Tommy, what does a convention mean when a convention's coming up? How do you prepare?
I used to like the conventions. Well, when I had Fat Tommy Promotions before I had a job. So before I had a job, I had Fat Tommy Promotions that had the, so I had the Arista account, the LaFace account, the Rowdy Records account, Wu-Tang was on.
Rowdy was down in Austin.
The Loud Records account, Tribe, the Jive Records account, the RCA account. So I would get all of those records. So for me going to the conventions, I would be there trying to get with promotions people and snatch up accounts. So I'm at the conventions trying to get as many accounts as I can, meeting people, telling them I'm doing the promotions in Richmond, Raleigh, Greensboro, and Charlotte. You know, I got the whole little area, Richmond, Raleigh, Greensboro, and Charlotte. That's what I'm running around telling people. I know all the DJs, I know all the stores, and I know all the clubs. Richmond, Raleigh, Greensboro, and Charlotte. When I first got in the business, they had the, North Carolina had the North Carolina Program Directors Coalition. All the programmers from Black Radio in North Carolina would meet. And so that was my first introduction. A dude by the name of Philip Van Poole introduced me to Cy Young. And I was in. I joined the Black Programmers Coalition just to learn and meet all the guys. And from there, the conventions would be an opportunity where you could see all the program directors. Or if you had dreams and aspirations of being on a national, you could see program directors from all over the country. You can see DJs from all over the country. Mm. And if you were trying to get into the business, there was a lot of information. They would have, like if it was today, they would have like a seminar on the 360 deal. They would have a seminar on social media promotion. They would have a seminar on TikTok promotion. They would have what to tweet and what not to tweet. You know, these are the things that we're at a convention right now. What record companies are looking for in an artist, you know, would be one. So then you go there as an artist and be like, okay, so it's a bunch of A&R people here telling you that they're looking for some traction in TikTok. They're looking for 50,000 followers on Instagram. You know, they're looking for you to post regularly. You would notice if you are at a convention and you have the A&R people telling you what they're looking for. So it's a lot. And then if you wanted a job other than being an artist, maybe you want to be an A&R director. Maybe you want to be a sound engineer, maybe in marketing, maybe you're a publicist. That's who's at all these conventions.
Do you remember the first convention that you went to?
Jack the Rapper in Atlanta. So I went from Dallas to Atlanta. So I happened to be in Atlanta at the time that hip-hop was being introduced. So I was blessed to promote the Phoenix Nightclub. You know, Little John was our DJ. Yeah. So I learned all about promotion in Atlanta. Just doing promotion for Damian Dame. I met Dallas Austin. He had Y'all So Stupid, and he had the Highland Place Mobsters and Monica. So I'm in Atlanta at the time when Dallas is blowing up. You know, Bobby Brown is running around. Him and Whitney, they running around Atlanta.
That explains a lot. I was working at Throwback Station here, and Nabs was on Saturday night, one night.
Yeah, Nabs was on, yep.
And he dropped that Highland Place Mobsters. And since you said that was Atlanta record, Dallas Austin, that explains why he dropped the record, because I promise you that record was not jumping nowhere else.
You're right. The Highland Place Mobsters. So we did that, and that's what taught me just about promotion. So when I get to Virginia and the dude there, Clonic, tells me record promotion is what I want to do, he's introducing me to everybody and co-signing for me to call these people so that they'll take the call. So when the Wu-Tang comes to town, Ed is like a short white guy, probably like 5'5". And he's like from Hawaii. And he has the Wu-Tang Clan. He calls me up and he's very nervous, intimidated. He says, look, I got the Wu-Tang Clan. It's like 20 big black guys is all I know, man. And they're very intimidating. I'm nervous and scared. So look, you know how to do the run. I'll meet you at Piccadilly, pay for lunch, and then you go with them. Trust me, you can do this. And I did that. And when I did that for him, you know, I met the Wu-Tang, met all of them. I got Ed through it. Man, Ed wrote so many letters to record companies. I got the Arista account. You know, that's when the account started coming, because once I did that, and then the girl from Loud Records was co-signing me because I finished the run. She said, yeah, I knew he couldn't take it. I jumped in, did the run. And so I had a letter from the rep at Loud. I can't even remember the sister's name, but I had a letter from her, and the Wu-Tang is blowing up. Mm. So by now, I done came back to Virginia because this is crazy, but Andre Willis then is blowing up. The club is blowing up, and the dude who's Andre's partner gets killed. Boom, they murk him out, then they try to frame Andre for a murder of a judge's wife, a white woman. So all of this is going on, and now there's internal fighting because there's money missing when the dude, Andre's partner, gets missing. So they're fighting. I leave to come back to Virginia. So I go, you know, I'm leaving. I come to Virginia. My friend of mine is like the manager of one of the biggest hotels, and she knows Ed Klonick, who's the BMG rep. That's how I meet Ed. I do all this work for Ed, and the next thing you know, the Wu-Tang comes. I set it up, and that blows my company up. Once I get the Wu-Tang and the Outkast account now, I'm working all these records, and it's easy to get a record because everybody will say, what record are you working?
Right.
You know, I was saying, like, at one time I had a Bad Boy record. So I would have a Biggie record, a Craig Mack record, a Wu-Tang record. I had the Alcoholics at that same time. Oh, and Keith Murray, the most beautiful thing. Yes. So I had all five of those records taken to the DJs at the same time. So right. When I would come into North Carolina, I would have DJs calling me, "You guys, what records you getting this week? What records you getting?" You know, so.
Yeah. I remember that period of time is when I was living with K Nice and he was on 102.
Yeah, I remember K. Yep. I used to give him all them records. Yep.
Right. I remember because as a DJ living with K Nice, I'm trying to get first dibs on his promos.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So everything you distributed to him, I got my hands on.
So the hustle was, my man Eric Lee was a music director. He set up a record pool. So I co-signed for him to be in the record pool. So he started getting all these records. I didn't know the record pools charged DJs for the records. That was interesting. But yeah, he had a record pool, so he would get all the records.
How did you get money off this? How did the promotion game work?
So record companies would pay me. Back then, I was getting $1,500 a record for 4 weeks. You would say 6 weeks, but the last 2 weeks is just you reporting what happened. If it ain't happening, look, if it's not happening, it's not happening. We don't have nothing to talk about. We know in 4 weeks if it's happening, I'll send you the report week five, and then if it's happening, they're going to re-up. You know what I'm saying? Like now they're going to say, we'll pay you for 4 more weeks because the record's happening. So it's important for you to make the record happen because you're trying to get another check. You know? Mm-hmm. So you got that. Then they would send me 300 promotional CDs. You know, so I would have like, I got like 300, the 36 Chambers, 300 Ready to Die, 300 Southern Playalistic Funky Cadillac Music. So, you know, I would pay my rent with promo stuff. That's how I would know if I had a good record.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a good album, people would pay me for it. Yeah, right. I would go in the barbershop and they would be like, oh, I want that.
I used to get it the same way with the promos. Like, when you guys would send stuff out, I'd be like, hey, man, if you got a good record, send me like 6 copies of that Joker. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I have 2 for me and I can sell the other 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would never do that.
Right.
I would never. I would hold them things like they was gold because they were. I literally, when they would send me all them cassette singles, I would sit there with an X-Acto knife and take the not sale off and sell the singles to the stores. So Willie's Records, Lou would buy all my stuff. Lou would buy it. I started out selling it to the mom and pops. The mom and pops would pay me for it. But then Lou said, look, I'll buy all of it. You know, Lou Rosenthal said, look, I'll buy everything. They're only going to buy what's hot. I'll buy it all. And so I would sell Lou a good portion of it. Definitely the stuff I couldn't sell over there, I would go sell to Lou like as yet. You know, no record stores wanted as yet, but Lou would buy the as yet. Donnell Jones, they would take it, but they wouldn't really like, Lou would buy all of it. Like, give me all the Donnell Jones. You know, the mom and pops might take a box here, a box there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting thousands of them.
Now, how important was the DJ to the radio success?
Well, the DJs, I could tell a record was hot by going in the club. I would go to the club because I want to see what happens. I would stay there at the 12 o'clock hour and try to get my record played at the 12 o'clock hour and see what's happening, you know, and how the crowd move. And I would know instantly. Like, I could hear the record, but then I would want to see it so that I could just pass that energy on to the DJ when I'm telling them, because I'm saying, look, I'm watching them run to the dance floor. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm telling them stuff like, I bet you they'll run to the floor. Come on, let's do it. So, you know, and I really had good records. I was on the cutting edge of what was happening.
Dope.
I mean, if you think about it, think about all those albums had a single, four singles on them that I just named.
Right.
And Players Ball, back then you had 4 singles. So I had put 4 singles on 4 Outkast records. Mm-hmm. I had 4 Wu-Tang records. 4 Biggie records, 2 Craig Mack records, because we had the Flavor in Your Ear, the Flavor in Your Ear remix.
Get Down came next.
What you going to do when, yeah, Get Down and Puff on the other side, Making Moves with Puff, I think, was on the other side. Mm-hmm. So, and then I had Midnight Marauders. I had Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, the Code Red, I think that was Summertime. I had KRS-One, Return of the Boom Bap. Mm. So I had a lot of great records at a good time when everything was jumping. And then I would get access to the artists. Mm. So because I promoted the record, I would call and get a good deal. And then I set it up so that if I got an artist, I would do the whole run where I worked. So I met the dude that in Raleigh that had whatever club, the Ritz in Raleigh.
Okay.
I knew that dude, so I would go and do the Ritz. I would go see him, and then in Fayetteville, they had a club, and they had one in Charlotte. And I would talk to the club owner, and I would bring them and do that run, and we would book 4 dates. So now I'm getting a discount. So I was making as much money as the artist was when he coming to town.
Jeez.
You know, I would get a discount and then put it back on it and pay it to myself.
Mm-hmm. So,
and then snatch a percentage of the door with the club owner, you know, telling him I'll just ride with him. He could split the club, the door with me. So he paid for the artist and give me half the money.
Right. Well, I call that hand-to-hand combat, where you're actually putting faces and shaking hands.
You had definitely.
How do you think that approach works now?
Well, the challenge is this. It absolutely would work now, but what happens is when you don't do that, then you don't have the club, then the artists don't have the club, so then they don't have the frenzy. When you start taking one piece away, you're taking away the frenzy and the fanfare that's making people rush out to want to see them. Even when you make it too easy for them to get the music, it was something when there was something required when you had to wait till Friday to get it. You know, people trying to get it early. You know, it's like all of that. That's a build up to fanfare. And then you actually got to go somewhere and get it, you know. And then you got to hope it's there or did somebody buy them all.
Yeah,
you know,
every Friday and Saturday night means something on the radio because you're listening, trying to see what's new, what's getting ready to drop, where they're going to premiere.
And I think that
fanfare also generates income. Mm-hmm. You know, you got the income of the DJ. Whether you pay them or not, somebody's getting paid, so that money's there. Not only that, but the DJ's getting paid to come to the club at night and work. You know, he got to get that. And then the artist comes to the club to support the DJ. Whether he's getting paid or not, he's supporting the DJ who played his record. Because if the DJ didn't play his record, don't nobody want him at the club. The only reason why they want him at the club is because the DJ played the record. Mm-hmm. So even like the Goody Mob, who's that peeking in your window? Even when Richmond wasn't on it as a radio station, I had all the clubs on it. So I remember I had so many records on the radio that there was no room. So they had to take one of my records off to put another record on. Like we had Tony Braxton, TLC, Faith, Total, Biggie, Craig Mack. You know, you got, that's 6 records. On a 20 record slot, you know what I'm saying?
Right,
so
right. The
biggest problem I had when I started going to the radio was what record am I going to take off? Because that was the biggest thing. But the whole catch was trying to keep your slot. Once I got to 6 slots, I tried to stay at 6 slots. So I was trying to replace a record with a record, you know, holding. Because, you know, one time I had 4 records on. Then I got 5 records. Now I got 6 records. So now I'm trying to keep all 6 on. And anytime I replace a record, when it's dropping and about to remove, I want to have one coming up. And that was the game. Dope. So you stayed getting checks and you stayed keeping records in rotation. So you stayed in the radio station. So the DJs was constantly seeing you. You stayed feeding them. Like, you know, I'm in Greensboro taking people out to dinner, you know, 2 times a month. You know, and I'm doing the same thing in Charlotte and Richmond. And now I done became a national, so I'm doing it all over the country. So, you know, I'm in Chicago with the DJs, and I'm in Los Angeles with the Baker Boys, and I'm in Oakland with Sway and Tech, and, you know.
You know, and what's cool about it as a DJ, you know, we're not getting rich at the radio stations.
Oh yeah, so we
wait. You know, like when you guys come through, that is the payoff. Like even if it's just going like to eat somewhere that you're not going to eat at regularly,
right?
Like
right, and bringing you to the convention. Like we can't pay you, but we can buy you a ticket to the convention.
Right,
put you up in a hotel room, and then you at least get to come and hang out and get a vacation paid for.
Right.
By the company.
Yeah, and you know, around
if you was a good DJ, a lot of times you could get a plus one. You know, if you was married, you know, you couldn't just bring anybody, but if you was legit married, you could get a plus one on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
For me anyway, you know, I can't speak for nobody else. But if you was married in a serious relationship, you could get a plus one with me. Especially if I looked up in my records, if you played Chino Excel, then shoot. You know, the sky's the limit. Whatever you ask me for.
I'm a creep.
Hey, so you touched on the accessibility of music. What do you mean by that?
Say that again.
You touched on accessibility of music, like how much music is accessible.
I think that was during the that was when we were talking about how people used to have to wait to get it on Tuesday or Thursday, Friday, whenever it released. Now, you know, you don't have to wait.
It's at my fingers. It's right there at my touch. So if it's that accessible, then it no longer has the urgency to it, the buildup, because it's just on my phone. I mean, think about how many times now a record will come out and people haven't even heard it, and you got iTunes. Like, how could you say you never heard a record and you got iTunes? Like, you got just go to iTunes and play it. So it's too accessible, so people, to me, the appreciation has gone down. That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me
think
about
the next generation, not to those of us who grew up appreciating music. People that grew up appreciating music still appreciate it. But the those that come after it.
Accessibility
my daughter
killed the
14,
album.
She can throw you away, but she buys albums, real ones. She got Tyler, the Creator's album. She went asked for Graduation for Christmas, the vinyl. You know, my daughter got Tyler, the Creator. She got a record player.
It's funny you say Kanye, because that's what this reminds me of. Because Kanye's last album with Ty Dolla $ign,
mm-hmm.
they took it off all streaming platforms, and now it's only available on Kanye's website.
Right, and Pharrell released the record that you had to buy it.
Hmm.
Dope. And Taylor Swift did only CDs for the first 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Damn. Those are some of the biggest names.
They're wising up. They're wising up. Like, accessibility is not good. It's not a good thing for the industry.
Right.
And you know, the cowboy I work with, I tell people all the time, Michael Knight makes $1 million a year selling CDs.
Who?
Really?
Michael Knight. Yeah. MIKELKNIGHT.
Oh, right,
Michael
right.
Knight.
Wow.
That's dope.
He still sells CDs. Never stopped.
So talking about the accessibility of music and how music is everywhere. And I'm glad Cap J just said that part about it. It kind of devalues the music. And it made me think about, I'm always going on these tangents, I guess. But it made me think about the Drake and the beef with the folks he's beefing with. Because if you think about how much music Drake puts out over the course of, let's just say, the past 5 years, like, it's so much. And me as an artist, like, it's always a level of competition as an artist. Then it's expected for the competition to come at this machine. And not to say there's a machine pushing Drake, because Drake puts out so many hits, but it's almost like he's operating like a machine when I'm operating as a creative. And this is the first time we've seen this at this level for this amount of time.
Well, absolutely, Drake has a machine behind him, without a doubt. That's a fact.
Yes.
And it's interesting that you said Drake, because I used to talk about Drake all the time. And so what I did probably 2 weeks ago was I listened to Drake's whole album.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his whole catalog.
Oh, wow.
From start to finish. It took some hours, but out of that, I found that I like 29 records.
Out of 29 all records. That?
Yeah. 29 wow. records. It's almost, it came out to almost be two records on every album.
But you know what? 29 records from any artist is a lot.
That's a lot. That means
they put out, you know what? I said that, but you know what? He put out so much music that, look, he got, his average album is like 27, 28 songs. Like, he got 28 songs. And when you start listening, it's all to girls. Like, a girl should love Drake, but I can't get it. So I like the two songs he do, you know, for the streets and the dudes. He usually do one or two records for them, and those are the two that I like. And it came out to be 29 records. I said to my wife, I got to say I like Drake. Like, he got 29 records that I really rock with.
Yeah, how many other artists got, like, some of my favorite artists, I can't think of 29 songs, like, for real, yeah, that move me.
Okay, now, if he's put out a record a year, and he costs, say he's been out 10 years, and he got 29 records on, 25 records on, that's 250 songs. Out of 250 songs, I only like 25. That's terrible.
Well not it, really. Because
yes, it is really.
Hey, think about it like this. Terrible. Think about it like this. Most artists on every album, like as a DJ, all I'm doing when I'm making mixtapes is picking the best songs to me off of each album. You got the single that dropped and that might be hot, and then there's an album cut that's really fire. That's kind of average. That's kind of what your average artist is going to give you, a hot single and a hot album cut. And the rest of the stuff is filler. You can get by for the moment, but you always come back to those two or three songs that you love. And I can do it for every album. Like, take Tribe Called Quest's first album. I loved it to death, right? Front to back. But what stood the test of time? For me, Benita Applebaum and The Luck of Lucienne. Like, Benita Applebaum is the hit single that I loved. Luck of Lucienne was the album cut that I loved. I liked all those other songs, but would I really listen to it when I'm in the mood? No, I'm going to pick those two songs.
Now, I'm a music connoisseur. So that means I buy music, you know. So when I buy music, this was my rule. My rule was, if you had four records that I like, it was worth it to me.
At least four or five.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I always like those like. But you know, now that I'm older, I look back on albums like, yeah, I liked them at the time.
Right.
But what do I still go back to?
Right.
Is it four?
Well, when I go back and listen to albums, I go back and listen to see if the record stood the test of time. And when I do that, I mean, I do that in my class just for work. And then listening. So one, I listen to J. Cole's whole catalog. I think J. Cole's catalog is good. There's very few records I skip when I play J. Cole over and over.
And why is that?
Cole makes good records.
I had to ask myself, I said, am I biased because he's from North Carolina, or is this dude that great?
Cole makes good records.
Like, yes.
The records that I tend not to like is Dreamville. The Dreamville stuff. But when I'm just listening to a Cole album,
yes.
I rode from Denver. I had to drive from Denver to Nashville. And the only thing I listened to on that entire drive was J. Cole over and over and over. I said, okay, it's really good. So
and even the songs that you skip, you still know them.
I didn't skip any. I'm a Cole. Cole is going to be the next one up to be pushed into the greatest of all time. Like, if we had a real Hall of Fame, I would be arguing for Cole's membership probably four albums ago.
You know, so we agree on that. Yes.
I've been arguing ever since he did the HBO. Ever since HBO, I say, oh, that solidifies it. He's in the Hall of Fame with me. Yeah.
You know what? An artist for me like that is like who I think that, well, there are two. It was Tyler the Creator, the most recent artist who I say I just put the CD in and I know that I'm getting ready to go on a ride with this artist. It's Tyler the Creator and MF Doom.
With who?
Tyler the Creator and MF Doom.
Okay, so
those are the two. Those are the two.
I have a greatest of the year, you know, in my class, they have to fight on who's the greatest of all time, the GOAT competition, and I give out a GOAT, right? So I've had Tyler the Creator this year. People fought for Tyler the Creator, and people have fought for MF Doom.
Wow.
Guess who in 4 years, 8 semesters, no one's never fought for?
Gucci.
Jay-Z.
Biggie.
Biggie?
Yeah.
Now, I got to say that, to me, the first Biggie album is, that was an album that I could do front to back.
I mean, and rap every word.
Yeah, the front. That was a front to back album from the time you played it, from the time it came on to the time it went off. And I thought it was one of the greatest full length albums, hip hop albums of all time. Right up there with Illmatic.
Yeah.
Ready to Die.
Ready to Die.
Ready to Die. Like, I don't. I don't see any flaws on that album.
Nothing.
This gonna be breaking news right here. This gonna be breaking news.
Okay? Uh oh.
Breaking news. You can stop the presses and go right to it with this. Biggie was like liquor to me. When I first drank it, I hated it. It was garbage. But after I just drank it over and over and over, I learned to like it.
But that sounds like radio.
And see, for me, Biggie was like Reese's. The first time I bit into it, I was like, oh my God.
The first time I
Ready to Die, you know.
Ready to
I'm
Die.
I'm like the mad rapper. It was all right. It was all right. It was all right. Ready to Die. That Ready to Die shit, it was all right. It was
all
right. But I'm on my fifth album.
I know is that, now when you say that though, when you say that in a room full of other hip hop heads, what is the response? Because right now, like I say, hey, I'm not in agreement with that right there. They're Ready to Die.
Man.
Like, I listen to a lot of hip hop. You know what I'm saying?
I like the album now. I mean, when I listen to it, different flows and everything, it shows that Biggie was talented. But my students will tell you that he said he would fuck Raven Simone. At that point, it's a wrap because she wasn't but 9 years old at the time. So at that point,
but this is before everybody was all sensitive. Yeah. Nobody cared. Nobody gave a damn back then.
It was witty. It was witty.
That's totally not true though, because those of us that grew up conscious and was listening to Poe Righteous Teachers and all of them was opposed to that. Like
you're the first person I ever heard bring that up.
Right.
You know why? Because people see what happens is this. New Yorkers, see, I'm from Connecticut, and New Yorkers, the way New Yorkers are is they don't care if you're right or wrong. Once they say we doing this, then it got to be made right. So when they had the Gods and they had Rakim and they had KRS-One, that was real hip hop. Now, true, N.W.A. came in and started cursing, and then you had Biggie and the Wu-Tang jump on that, and Biggie trying to give you the big shot value and going for that, and that is great, and it's to be applauded the way he told stories and put his word game together and everything. But as a community and as the culture of hip-hop, peace, love, unity, and safely having fun, one could argue that it's not even hip-hop.
Hey, Dreams was not on Ready to Die.
Oh my
Dreams,
God.
That song was not on Ready to Die. So I don't even know why we're talking about that song.
Yeah,
that wasn't but on that, the record that, at all. Okay. You know what I'm saying?
But wait, when people talk about the record, most people are talking about the remix that you hear on the radio.
Right.
Because the radio songs sound totally different than the actual album verses.
But even the album versions, I loved it. Like, One More Chance, the original. Yeah, oh, Biggie, give me one more chance. I don't care about the remix.
I worked all
not.
Of that. Listen, I loved all of that. I loved Biggie. He was like, but when I look at his body of work and I put it all together and I ask myself, what is the criteria for why I'm making these decisions? And I actually formulate a criteria instead of just making a decision out of emotion and what I worked and what I got to check for and what the consensus of all the people are. But I take all of that away and go, what does hip hop mean to me, and what did I really believe it was, and what it's supposed to be about? then I look at it from a more crucial lens. And then I would say that the greatest of all time would have to be KRS-One. It would have to be like Chris is in a league all by itself. That no one's better than the teacher. And then the closest thing would be the God. So we got a God and a teacher.
You're talking about Rakim, right?
Rakim, yeah. We got a God and we got a teacher.
You know something?
Biggie.
Is a child of theirs.
Biggie, NWA, and all of them were the beginning or part of the destruction of hip hop. Almost the way the Black Panther Party was destroyed.
How
they attacked and blew up and destroyed hip hop. They took something that was used to unify us and pull us together that kids decided to do instead of fighting, that they was going to rap. And then they turned it into the most violent sport and turned it against us and weaponized it.
Well, tell me this. Why doesn't KRS Criminal Minded fall into that category?
It does, absolutely. But then he grew up. He was like, oh, junk, this got my friend. This got Scott LaRock killed. I got to think better now.
Biggie
died. I got to learn from this.
Yeah,
I gotta learn from this.
Hey, let me throw this in there. As much as I was enjoying Ready to Die, I can also say that at that same time when Tupac was on that Thug Life movement and he was also working with Easy Mo B, I was just as much of a fan of that Thug Life album. I thought that was the best we had. Temptations, right?
Yeah.
So Many Tears, that era right there.
Right.
Tupac and Biggie, when they weren't feuding and they working with the same producer, I was on both of them.
Okay.
I think Tupac was a bigger iconic figure and I liked him for more out of the booth antics than the things he did as an artist. And I love Tupac too. You know what? This should not come on. Machiavelli is like, I love that album, and Strictly for My Niggas, I love them. But here's a couple of things that I noticed just in life. I don't think the Chronic stood the test of time. I went back and listened to it and said,
"Me too." You go back and Chronic 2001
is dope.
Hit a little bit differently.
Yes.
I haven't listened to that. I didn't even go there. But I thought Ice Cube stood the test. Lethal Injection, The Predator, America's Most Wanted.
America's Most Wanted, it was genius.
Yes.
Man, they still hit the same. It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back still hits the same.
You know, I went back and Paid in Full was incredible. But I went back and listened to Ultra Mag. I listened to Ultra Magnetics. Ego, what was the first album? But anyway, I listened to that first album because I remember how much I used to love it back in the day. And when I went back and listened to it, I was like, nah, this didn't stand the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
Outkast stood the test of time. Outkast album.
Yes.
The Soul Food Goody Mob album.
What? Album. Classic.
Oh, man.
Classic. Classic. Yeah. Old Dirty Bastard didn't stand the test of time.
Hey, no, I can go back and listen to that first Old Dirty.
Nah.
Like, that was one of my favorite albums of all time. Artistic. It was art.
Yeah.
It was art. And I saw it as art. You know what I'm saying? Different.
I think if you go back and listen to the GZA, he
Liquid Swords.
The Wu-Tang aged well.
Cuban Links.
36
Chambers. Oh. Yeah.
He said nah.
But I don't think that the Triumph album aged as well though.
I didn't like that when I first heard it.
Triumph.
Yeah, I think they used all their ammo with 36 Chambers and Cuban Links, and everything after that didn't have the entirety that those two albums had. They had great songs here or there,
right?
But there was not another full album. At least not until like Supreme. I thought Supreme Clientele helped capture a little bit of that, but that wasn't all RZA either,
right? They were working
with. Well, I thought Illmatic stood the test of time.
Oh, no doubt.
Right now.
No doubt.
Yes.
And Stillmatic. I'm not sure. I enjoy Stillmatic too.
I'm not sure that Jay-Z, I think he was required to grow. I think the stuff after 444 will last longer than the stuff before.
I think the blueprint is going to stand forever. I think the blueprint.
The blueprint's a good album.
The blueprint is my favorite. That's my favorite Jay-Z front to back. That's the one that I put in and like kind of like Scarface the Fix.
Mm-hmm.
I put in. Ooh. I listened to the whole thing.
What happens if it's proven that he's a pedophile? Then what happens?
Who, Scarface?
Oh, Jay-Z. I mean, Jay-Z. If it's proven, Jay-Z. Here's the thing. I never liked Jay-Z so much that. Right. That I care away. Like I'm not like I've already thrown the album away. I don't go like, back and listen to it. I don't listen
R.
to Jay-Z all the time. You
he
know
ain't R. Kelly.
Like yeah, you conflicted with R. Kelly.
I can't stop listening, man.
Right, but with Jay-Z I'm not like I'm I don't really care. Because I think it's because Jay-Z has given me so much that I OD'd on Jay-Z.
Yes.
And yeah. it doesn't have
I'm
the
so
impact
glad I
anymore.
Didn't I'm so glad I didn't. I wasn't even a Jay-Z fan. As a matter of fact, I used to say Jay-Z would be AZ if Biggie was still alive. Y'all wouldn't even know. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. It'd be
AZ. I agree.
He would.
I think Jay-Z is extremely overrated. But at the same time, I also see why he deserves the props and the respect and the credit that he gets.
That dude's got poor words.
But, you know.
Like Bluetooth.
I mean, I get it.
Don't nobody write rhymes no more.
I get it.
It's been 25 years and ain't nobody wrote a rhyme. Because they say he do it.
I think the thing that kept me from putting Jay-Z over the top is his lack of personality injection.
J call him simple.
He's like two clicks above Drake.
The
like
king
Drake,
of simplicity.
Drake got an excuse because he's from Canada, so he's supposed to be corny.
But Jay did it on purpose.
No, it's not on purpose, Jay. Like I remember seeing Jay-Z like when he was rolling with Big Daddy Kane back in the day. He's always been extremely lyrical. Always been a great lyricist, great rapper. But it's showman. He's not a showman.
Oh,
and yeah. I like MCs that give me something else other than like you know, a sense of presence on the stage.
Well, Rakim
in person.
Just tell him don't rock him, but he just give you those
he didn't.
Words.
He didn't, but the right. difference is he had a
he
voice.
Got flow,
his
right.
voice
no,
commanded.
He was good. That's
his
the
voice
commanded.
But
so, he was good.
So
but Jay-Z,
like
Jay-Z had some great words.
Good.
But Rakim had a voice. His voice was the presence.
If Jay-Z had all
great words.
Who, Rakim?
Listen, if Biggie wouldn't have died and all of Brooklyn wouldn't have just demanded,
it was
they
over.
Just punked the rest of New York. They just said, yes. Yo, we taking this. That's what it is.
Yep.
Brooklyn keeps taking it, and they just took it. There wasn't.
Yep.
Look, Nas is way better.
Okay? Oh, yeah, Nas was way better with his words, but
yes.
I've heard enough out of Jay-Z to know that he had more to offer than what he gave
us. No, you know what
too.
He had? Jay-Z, no. Jay-Z got co-signed. They would say he was an agent. A plant nowadays is what they would call him. He got co-signed by Massa, cut the throat of his men's in them, left them hanging, and rode off into the sunset with the man. That's what he did.
But I'm not going to argue against this at all, because I'm the only person that's saying that Jay-Z ain't the number one. To me, he's not
right,
my number
what
one.
What they did was, when you do that, right, then the machine gets behind you. So then you have to really go back and listen. And if you go back and listen to all them albums, just please go back and try to listen. And it's not even a stretch for me to say that J. Cole is a better rapper.
Hey, but Tony, I'm sorry, because we've been talking about this for a while now. But I did have a question for you that was more so because you mentioned earlier about you being into racing. And I know how sometimes hip-hop, lack of a better word, infiltrates certain environments. Have you thought about how hip hop can correlate with car racing? And the reason why I ask, because I know a lot
of Martinsville, that's you talking about NASCAR country though. They ain't messing with no hip hop. I don't see it.
Well, Michael Knight created this lane called urban country or country rap. He was out before Lil Nas X. His whole vision was to bring the people that live on the edge of the city with the people that live on the edge of the country. So, like, when we go out and sell our CDs, we don't sell in Greensboro, but we sell all around. You know, we'll sell in Winston-Salem. We'll sell everywhere. When we go to Charlotte, we'll sell in Concord, but we won't sell in Charlotte.
Right.
You know, so we sell right on the edge of the city.
And Concord, now that's NASCAR territory right there. Like, you know, that's
but
basically
that's really his market.
Right.
That's who he, that's his target audience. Word. So, and they rap, and so now it's a little more open, you know, for hip hop. But what I found is that everybody like hip hop. Like I've been out on the road with self-defining rednecks. They got Confederate flag tattoos on their arms that love. I was at the Redneck Yacht Club, which is in Alabama, and they were flying Confederate flags and listening to Kevin Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah,
he crossed over.
Yeah.
But hip hop has always been, ever since there was a Run DMC, white people have been buying hip hop.
Yeah.
I mean, who do you think bought all that? They brought the Beastie
Boys. Honestly, I got Dana Dane and Eric B. and Rakim's first album from a white dude.
Wow.
NWA was bought by white people. That's the only way MTV and all of them would jump on that. Mm-hmm. That was a predominantly white movement.
How about go to a Public Enemy concert right now? You know, you're going to be outnumbered.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
They tour with Anthrax.
Yeah, they rock
they
out
on tour
Public
with
Enemy.
Anthrax, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's who bought all Tupac stuff after he died.
Yeah, mm-hmm. When you go to a throwback hip-hop show, you get the right artists in there, you'll have a mixed crowd, an evenly mixed crowd easily. Like, especially when you start talking about the mid to late 90s, when hip hop was the language of the land.
Well, it's going to be white people.
Yeah, white people, they love KRS. They rock out. But, you know, they as the same way with jazz and blues, a part of me feels like one day those are going to be the people who herald true hip hop the same way that they keep true jazz and true blues going. Like when you go, mm-hmm. it's white people there.
Because
mm-hmm. they're the ones that go back and really appreciate the true mm-hmm. nature of the genre. So I think hip hop will be headed that
but
way.
They're the ones
you know.
That destroy it in the beginning.
Yeah, but
in
then
the
come back, but then come back and tell you that this is real. You know, here's
right.
what's real.
They're the ones, buying. Right, they're the ones buying the garbage.
Right,
that's being forced forward. But
then later on, they'll tell you that's garbage and you know.
And buy the classic, right? Be back on the classic.
Oh, right, right. That time is coming, man.
So many of
hip-hop
them.
Hip-hop's been so far, man. We've been down so many roads. Like, what do you think about the state of hip-hop right now? When you listen to, you know, I hate to, like, I don't want to make Sexy Red a scapegoat for everything in hip-hop right now because there's always been a Sexy Red somewhere. At least for the past 15, 20 years, there's been some iteration of a Sexy Red type character out there. But, like, right now, she's one of the hottest out. When you hear Sexy Red, with all the time that you spent in the game, you've done promotions, what's your take right now? And I don't mean just, like, in any particular, like, I don't have any particular lane to get you to think. Like, just when you hear Sexy Red on the radio, what does your mind say?
My neck, my back, lick my
Kaya.
And my crap.
Right. Yes. Right. Kaya all over right. again. But I mean, but Kaya couldn't duplicate the success over and over. Like she's on a run. It's different than Kaya, it's different than Jackie O. And
well, but see, I don't consider when I start thinking about what is hip hop right now, I would lean more towards Tyler the Creator. I would lean towards J. Cole. I would lean towards Kendrick Lamar. The rest of that stuff is just rap music that's just being played just to market and push. But hip hop, you have to really look for real hip hop. No different than before. The radio and the mainstream has never played
real hip hop. Even back in the day when people talk about the glory days, like the real hip hop has never, ever, ever, ever
made it to radio.
Ever made commercial.
Right.
I was surprised, like stepping into a world was one of the realest hip hop songs that ever went up the charts.
And how?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you how. It was singing the hook. They used a familiar hook from Blondie, Rapture.
Mm-hmm.
And KRS-One was able to get his biggest commercial single. But at the end of the day, everything about that song was still hip-hop. And it's one of the most hip-hop songs to go that far, I believe. You know what I'm saying?
Ja didn't really know how to work a hip-hop group. I mean, think about all the great records. They had Tribe Called Quest, Keith Murray, and KRS-One. And they couldn't really control the charts.
I thought they did good to get Step Into a World to do what it did, though.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hard sell at the time.
It was a hot record for commercial radio down south. But no, the first time I heard that record, I was crossing the George Washington Bridge, going into New York, heading to Connecticut.
This record went national, though, man. You're talking about New York artists playing in New York. That's cheating. We're talking about the rest of the country. We're talking about full-time airplay.
It was a great record,
but it was against the grain of the kind of hip-hop that normally did those type of numbers.
All great records are against the grain. The Wu-Tang Clan, Protect Your Neck, was definitely against the grain.
And Protect Your Neck did not do half of what Step Into a World did. Like, Protect Your Neck was never a commercial success.
But to think that made it to the radio. Just go play that record.
Cash Rules Everything Around Me didn't do what Step Into a World did.
Oh, yeah, but I don't think Wu-Tang probably had a record that was big as...
They had one that was Method Man and Mary J. Blige.
Yeah.
That's not a Wu-Tang record, but okay.
Okay. Yeah, Wu-Tang never had a record as successful. You're right. They never had a record as successful as Step Into a World. And, like, you know, that's evidence right there. Like, we know what hip-hop is.
That's why.
And you know it when you hear it. And when you heard Step Into a World, it's like, that ain't Nelly. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That ain't, you know, any, like, I'm you know what I'm talking about. Right. I can't even put it into words hardly. It's like, yo, that record was an anomaly. It's an anomaly for, like, you're talking about a core hip-hop artist. Like, this is not even a crossover artist.
Right.
Well, Steven, today the hip-hop, there's real hip-hop ain't on the radio. I mean, you can't, is Tyler the Creator, you don't hear on the radio? Like, I think you just heard his first record that was just out there.
You hardly hear Kendrick Lamar on the radio.
Right.
And they win Grammys.
Like us. Right. Right.
Right.
So, even Killer Mike, you know, he delivered us a hip hop album. People could argue that that's a pretty decent hip hop album. So,
yeah, I think Killer Mike is controversial statement here. I think that what's going on with Killer Mike is a product of a lot more than just his music. Let me put it like that.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I think Killer Mike has positioned
himself. It's almost
himself.
Like he's a great businessman.
He's a and he goes on Fox News. He goes
right
on CNN. Place. He's in the right place at the right time.
Right.
And they know him.
Right.
There's nothing controversial. Controversial. I don't think even that it's controversial to say that anybody who thinks that they tried to tell me that was supposed to be album of the year. That's what they told me. It was supposed to be hip hop album of the year. And then I asked if they listened to Nas's album. Because if you did, are you telling me that Killer Mike's gospel album is better than Nas's album? Or are you just telling me that it was time for the stuff? And then when it won the Grammy, it reminded me to say, of course it wasn't, because the Grammys, are you telling me that the Grammys for the first time in their life got it right? They didn't get it right.
No. No, they roll with the dude that they know that they rock with.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And they let him get arrested. That was a big stunt. It was just to put another black eye on hip hop, and he allowed them to, and that was great. It was awesome. All of them, I think, see, I put them all in the machine. He in the machine because he wouldn't get as much airtime if he wasn't. The only way you can get that much airtime is through a product of the machine.
Yeah, he's in the machine.
Who's not in. They don't give it to you if you're not in. You can't. You don't get the toys.
That's why anybody you see them on TV all the time.
Right. You can't trust
anybody playing with the toys is in the machine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Now, he knows how to use the machine to get his message, his agenda out there, which is what you're supposed to do. Once you get the machine and the voice, you're supposed to use it for whatever it is. If your agenda is to legalize marijuana, if your agenda is to get reparations, when you get the mic, that's what you got to do.
Hey, look, we are at our time limit right now, but Tommy, okay. I tell you, truthfully, you are one of my favorite people to talk hip-hop to. Give them a rundown. Got any information or anything you want to give to people?
Nope.
Okay, well, it's Fat Tommy. He's a long time industry guy. He's done everything. Right now, he's teaching classes at Virginia Commonwealth University, and we appreciate his presence. It's the Capital City Podcast. I'm your host, Capital J, alongside my main man,
DL Glass,
and we're out of here.